But now in the case of Hill against Madison County, Ms. Deutsch.
And your honors. Shall I begin?
Yes, please proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Deutsch, and I represent plaintiff appellant Hubert D. Hill. There are few stronger commands to the judiciary than Article III's prohibition on advisory opinions. Yet the district court here, quote, hereby ordered that judgment is hereby entered, that the dismissal shall count as a strike under Section 1915G of the Prison Litigation Reform Act. This issue was not presented and was not ripe for adjudication. As amicus admits, it rests upon contingent future.
Ms. Deutsch, you are beginning, as your brief does, with the Constitution. It's a pretty well-established principle that one begins with the statute. So why don't we begin with the statute?
Of course. The statute is clear on its face about when the Section 1915G inquiry ripens. It ripens when a prisoner brings an action and seeks to proceed IFP in forma pauperis under this section. Therefore, the question is not ripe and is not presented at the time of a dismissal. But that's what the district court here did. It committed a premature adjudication. It purported to adjudicate the application of Section 1915.
In your view, is the adjudication premature or wrong? I thought the argument in your brief was that this case simply can't count as a strike, no matter what. No matter when decided, no matter by whom, since it began in state court, it just can't be a strike.
It is true both that the adjudication was premature under the plain text of the PLRA, as well as the Constitution, and that it was wrong on the merits. The fact that the district court got the question plain wrong here goes to show precisely why it is inappropriate for courts to purport to adjudicate the application of Section 1915G at the time of the dismissal.
Counsel, I'm asking you to address the statute. It doesn't really address the statute just to assert your conclusion that it's plain wrong, because Ms. Owen thinks is going to tell us that it's right. I wish you'd do something other than give us your bottom line. An argument would help.
Of course, as to the merits of what the district court did here, it was incorrect because under Section 1915G, a dismissal only counts as a proverbial strike if the prisoner brought it in a court of the United States. Here, Mr. Hill brought the action, which Black's Law Dictionary defines as instituting the action, in state court, and defendants removed it to a court of the United States, which means under 28 U.S.C. 41.
The statutory argument for the other side. It would be something like, it's true this action was brought in state court, but when it arrived in federal court, the plaintiff continued to prosecute it rather than giving it up and dismissing it. And that continuing to prosecute an action removed to federal court counts as being brought in federal court. You might want to analyze that approach.
Of course. So first, under the statutory text, 28 U.S.C. Section 1914 tells us that the party that brings the action, the party that institutes the action, is the party that pays the filing fees. That, in this case, is defendants, the party that removed the case from state court to federal court. So Congress wrote a comprehensive scheme that makes sense together and defeats amicus's argument. But second, this court has already answered the question. In Gay versus Chandra, it contemplated precisely this contingency and said that and foreclosed and shut down expressly amicus's argument to the contrary. And the fact that the district court got the question wrong here goes to the broader statutory argument that I want to return to, which is that Congress gave instructions to courts at every stage of pro se prisoner litigation. Under Section 1915A, they can pre-screen complaints that are not meritorious. Under 1915E2, they can contemporaneously dismiss actions for failure to state a claim for frivolousness or maliciousness. And then under 1915G, when they are contemplating a pending application to proceed in form of papyrus, they can consider and should consider whether the prisoner's litigation history should erect a bar and cause them to deny the application to proceed in form of papyrus. Under that comprehensive reading of 1915, it's clear where the district court here jumped the gun. It first adjudicated the dismissal for failure to state a claim. That's fine and appropriate under 1915E2, but then it made a legal error under the statute. It purported to adjudicate the legal meaning of that dismissal under a different provision, section 1915G, under which it, at the time of dismissal, has no proper role. And the error here is important because the fact that the district court got it wrong is evidence of why district courts should not be prematurely adjudicating this under the statute. The district court here made a mistake.
Ms. Deutsch, would you have any problem if the judge had just said at the end of his order, outside the final judgment, in essence, this resolution appears to count as a strike under 1915G?
So I want to be, our line is clear. It is reversible error to prematurely adjudicate or decide the legal meaning of the dismissal under section 1915G. So this case is not a case about warnings.
So my question, the answer is that would not be pose a problem in your view.
That would not be reversible error in our view. We would not be here. That would not give rise to an appeal. We could have a separate conversation about the sort of merits and advisability of issuing those kinds of warnings. But again, this is not a case about warnings. This is a case about premature adjudications.
Well, so you both you and your colleagues and Ms. Owen and her colleagues have generously contributed time to help us out in this case. And I would at least be interested in what you think about what advice or guidance we should provide to district judges if we agree with you on the merits, or rather on the timing issue here.
Of course, our rule is simple. It is reversible error to prematurely adjudicate the application of section 1915G at the time of a dismissal, because the question is not presented. In terms of what to write, in terms of giving guidance, I would point your honors to the Third Circuit's cogent explanation of this rule and cogent guidance that it issued to district courts in Dooley, where it held the same and explained its reasoning in no more than 1 to 2 pages. As to guidance about warnings, as the district court's error here shows, district courts often mistake the grounds of dismissal under E2 for a one-to-one correlation for what counts as a strike under G. But that's wrong. There are a host of other legal questions that go into determining whether or not something is a strike under G. And for that reason, we also don't think that courts giving warnings that are often wrong and misadvising plaintiffs is a particularly good idea under the PLRA context. I see that I have only 2 minutes left, so I'd like to reserve.
Counsel, let me ask you about a different kind of warning, which is also common in pro se cases. Many pro se litigants seem to think that they can continue to litigate forever. And a district judge may well say at the end of some case, dear plaintiff, you have to understand that your case has now been resolved. You can't bring another identical case. And if you do, you're very likely to be facing sanctions. Do you think there's any constitutional problem with a judge saying that?
No, that hypothetical definitely falls on the side of warning and not on the side of adjudication. And I just want to direct the court's attention back to what the district court here said and did, which was use adjudicatory language to purport to decide the legal meaning of the dismissal, that is, decide the legal question. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Certainly, counsel. Ms. Owen.
Thank you. May it please the court. Megan Lacey Owen from Jones Day as appointed amicus. No appellant can come to this court without an injury. The injury Mr. Hill suffered as a result of the district court's order was the dismissal of his complaint, but he does not challenge that dismissal. Instead, he asks this court to edit the district court's description of its order as a strike, what this court has called a mere housekeeping matter. Mr. Hill's legal rights are the same today as they would be if the district court...
Both the district court, Ms. Owen, at the end of the opinion and as part of the judgment had said something like, and if you file another lawsuit about the same issue, the U.S. Marshal will immediately put you in prison, period. Do you think an appeal would be dismissed on the ground that that's just irrelevant dictum? Ms. Owen?
I'm not sure. I think the answer is yes, because it's not clear what the basis for that action would be. But what I will say...
I would say, Ms. Owen, it is often, this is from the perspective of an appellate judge, it's often not clear to the Court of Appeals what the basis of a district judge's decision is. And we often think it's wrong. But to say, well, it's uncertain what the basis of X is, and X is probably wrong, therefore you can't appeal, would be quite an extraordinary thing for the Court of Appeals to say.
I'll also say this, Judge Easterbrook, that scenario is much closer to what the scenario that this court addressed in Lucien, where this court vacated the district court's purported to call a prospective bar on informal pauperis filings. In other words, a ruling that actually purported to affect legal rights. The district court's description of its order as a strike here did not purport to affect any legal interest of Mr. Hill's whatsoever. Nothing about the district court's order purports to prevent Mr. Hill from seeking and being granted informal pauperis status tomorrow.
Why wouldn't he face a res judicata defense on the issue of his strike, particularly since it's in the judgment?
Judge Hamilton, as this court has said in Wallace, it is not up to a district court determining whether to grant or deny IFP status to defer to an earlier district court's determination that an order was a strike. Instead, a court determining whether a plaintiff is entitled to proceed in formo pauperis must make its own determination about whether dismissals in prior cases brought by that plaintiff count as strikes under Section 1915G. Apart from its dismissal of his claims, which Mr. Hill does not challenge, the district court here did not purport to affect Mr. Hill's legal rights at all. It did not purport to bar him from filing informal pauperis either now or in the future. That is one reason, of course, why Lucien is different. And the other key difference between this case and this court's opinion in Lucien is this, which is that in Lucien, of course, the plaintiff also challenged the dismissal of his claims. And that's also true of the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Bellinus. Indeed, the district court's description of its order as a strike here is simply a statement that cannot be appealed. The fact that it is part of the order and judgment does not matter because, as this court said in Wallace, a later district court has an independent obligation to assess the basis for dismissal in prior cases. So as this court said in Gleish, the strike notation is no more than a housekeeping matter, and it does not purport to affect Mr. Hill's legal rights any more than it binds later courts evaluating the question. I would note that the reply brief, I think, also dismisses this court's opinion in Duval too quickly. That case said that the only reason for publishing an opinion was to decide what it called the hitherto open question of whether our dismissal of the appeal is a strike under 28 U.S.C. Section 1915G. And while it's true that the court did not engage in a lengthy discussion about jurisdiction in that case, it was not an unconsidered opinion, and it was a published opinion. And the court appears comfortable with this practice. The court in Duval said that its dismissal would count as a strike. And this court has in other published opinions offered a description of the appellant's status with respect to strikes under Section 1915G. The same is true of this court's opinion in Gleish, where it described strike notations as housekeeping matters and announced that Gleish had accumulated one strike over the course of his two suits and one appeal. The warning that the district court gave the appellant is also appropriate. As I mentioned, this court has done so, at least in Duval, and the Supreme Court has done so in similar contexts. In Castro, the Supreme Court required federal courts to issue a warning before construing a motion under Section 2255 that future such motions would fall under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act's second or successive bar. And this is true even though a later court has to determine independently whether the Section 2255 motion is second or successive under that under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. So the point of the warning, as the Supreme Court explained, is to help the plaintiff understand whether the ruling is a thing that he should consider contesting on appeal. And I think the same could be said of the district court's description of its order as a strike here. I would like briefly to address the merits that Ms. Deutsch discussed. It would be plainly absurd to interpret Section 1915G as Mr. Hill does. The statute is to prevent federal courts from being overburdened with frivolous prisoner litigation filed without the deterrent effect of the filing plea.
Ms. Owen, your brief says the same thing, but it may be that you're assuming that the only way to discourage frivolous lawsuits is by counting them as strikes. What about the alternative of awarding sanctions?
That's another alternative, certainly, Judge Easterbrook. Although I would note that sanctions have been in the inherent power of the district court since before the enactment of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and so they would not explain.
Yes indeed. But my question is, what your argument appears to assume that unless a filing like this, filed in state court and removed to federal court, counts as a strike, there's no deterrent to frivolous litigation. And it seems to me that courts can deter frivolous litigation in lots of ways. So why should we make the assumption that is reflected in your brief and argument?
It is a way to give effect to the statute and to the object of the statute, which is to prevent federal courts from being overburdened with frivolous prisoner litigation. And these prisoner claims are claims under Section 1983 are removable on their face and predictably will be removed by the federal officers, by federal officers and others who are sued under them.
I hope it's not federal officers being sued under 1983 because it applies only to state action.
Excuse me, Judge Easterbrook, excuse me, yes. But the claims nevertheless arise under federal law and are removable. Section 1983 claims are removable to federal court and predictably will be removed, as some of the district courts cited in my brief have explained, and overburden the district court's dockets, which is the reason Congress enacted the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
So I guess I understand the reason, but this is a great demonstration of the old adage that no statute pursues its object without regard for any other. I'm botching the quote, but pursues its object regardless of all other concerns. And we have here the statutory language: in no event shall a prisoner bring a civil action in a court of the United States, which is a defined term. And it's hard for me to see how this prisoner brought a civil action in a court of the United States.
The answer, Judge Hamilton, is that he filed this suit, it was removed, and he continued to prosecute it on appeal in a court of the United States.
He did not bring it, which is the statutory term. And district courts have ample tools for dealing with frivolous pursuit of cases before them. Rule 11 kicks in after the removal, not before, right?
I don't know exactly when.
You can't impose Rule 11 sanctions in federal court for
correct.
A complaint that was filed in state court, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. I would think similar logic might suggest that this assessment of a strike would be wrong, particularly given the statutory language. But I don't know if we get there. So.
I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Deutsch?
Yes. Amicus advances an argument as it must, untethered from the statute. As then Judge Kavanaugh wrote in Four Star, if Congress wanted district courts to contemporaneously label their dismissals as strikes, it would have said so. But it said no such thing in the Prison Litigation Reform Act. Congress gave directions to district courts at every stage of litigation, and it was clear about when and how Section 1915E should apply contemporaneous dismissals, and clear about when Section 1915G should apply, when there is a pending application for to proceed in forma pauperis in a later lawsuit. Our rule follows straightforwardly from the text. It is reversible error for a district court to purport to adjudicate the legal meaning of Section 1915G at the time of dismissal. That is contrary to the statute that Congress wrote, and it is contrary to the basic tenet of Article 3 that requires courts to refrain from adjudicating cases or controversies not before them. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.